It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan finds herself on the other side of the bench today as deliberations in her federal trial get underway in Milwaukee.
A jury is hearing the case against Dugan, who is accused of concealing an immigrant to try to prevent his arrest by federal agents at the courthouse back in April. Dugan has pleaded not guilty to the charges.
The case has generated national attention. President Trump said over the summer that the case should not be dismissed. And this month, Illinois passed a law barring immigration and customs enforcement agents from its courtrooms. If convicted, the judge could face up to 6 years in prison.
To understand more about the case and its ramifications, we turn to two legal experts. Jacob Hamburger is an assistant professor of law at Marquette University Law School. Jacob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And John Gross is here, clinical associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of its Public Defender Project. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
John, let's start with you. Remind us, what happened back in April that led to these charges against Judge Dugan?
So back in April, there were a group of federal law enforcement officers from Immigration Customs Enforcement who were in the courthouse, and they were going to make an arrest of someone who had a court appearance in front of Judge Dugan. And that was something that was, in Judge Dugan's perspective, a little controversial. There had been ongoing discussion between federal agents and the chief judge in Milwaukee about how to conduct these operations and some concerns over that they might have a chilling effect on people's willingness to come to the courthouse.
And Jacob, you know, there's video footage from what happened in the courthouse that day that has circulated widely, and it shows the judge speaking to ICE agents in the hallway and then the defendant later leaving the courtroom by this jury door that's not open to the public and fleeing the courthouse. How pivotal could this footage be for the trial?
Well, I think the main factual issue in this trial is going to be what exactly was Judge Dugan's intent while all this was going on. What she's argued is that her intent is essentially to act as a judge and take lawful actions that are part of her authority to manage her courtroom. And so I think this video evidence, and as well as the audio transcript that's going on during the trial, I think leaves a lot of room for the jury to find really on either side that either, right, you know, it, possibly right, that she was trying to obstruct what the federal agents were doing, but also that she was simply trying to manage her courtroom or minimize disruption, or that there was some uncertainty, at least in her mind, about what the arrest plan of the ICE agents was at the time. So I think the evidence that the jury is going to see in this trial, you know, leaves a significant amount of room on both sides to interpret Judge Dugan's intent there.
John, what will you be watching for from the witness stand?
Well, I think in terms of the evidence that's going to be submitted, I don't think there's going to be a lot of factual dispute about what occurred. There's both video and audio that's going to be submitted. A number of law enforcement agents will testify about their interactions with Judge Dugan. I even expect that they'll call members of Judge Dugan's staff to testify about what went on inside the courtroom. But again, I think the question is going to be whether or not Judge Dugan had this corrupt intent, which is one of the elements of one of the charges, and whether or not her actions actually fit the definitions of concealment, which is what the other charge requires. And I think that's going to be very much in dispute, because even though she allows someone to exit her courtroom from maybe a door or a hallway that's not accessible to the public generally, that does lead to a public area, a hallway in the courtroom. And so I think there's going to be a lot of legal arguments about whether or not her actions actually fit the definitions of these two federal offenses.
And so, Jacob, 9 men, mm-hmm. 5 women on this jury. What arguments do you anticipate prosecutors will make in front of this jury?
Well, I think the arguments that they're going to make are you know, first of all, that the actions she took were intended to obstruct the federal immigration, the arrest plan to arrest Mr. Flores Ruiz, who was appearing in her court. So, they're going to look at the actions that she took and, you know, what the video shows about what those actions were, about leading him to this other door, for example, and trying to deduce from that, right, and also potentially using some circumstantial evidence, maybe about what she might have believed about a federal immigration enforcement, to try to show that what she was trying to do was to stop ICE from being ICE agents from being able to arrest Mr. Flores Ruiz and to ensure that he ultimately doesn't get arrested or deported. I think, as Professor Gross mentioned, that there's not a ton of factual material that will be in dispute. But what they're going to be trying to put together here is, from what we see in the courtroom and from maybe what we might know otherwise about her or about her views of the immigration landscape in general, the government's arguments are going to try to piece from that all that together some intent to obstruct or interfere with what the ICE agents were doing in the courtroom that day.
We're talking about the federal trial of Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan with two legal experts, Jacob Hamburger there at Marquette University Law School. John Gross is here from the UW Law School. John, Judge Dugan has assembled a pretty significant legal defense team. How will Dugan's defense attorneys try to counter the charges?
So I think they're going to target two main areas, which is one, the one charge does require that she have this corrupt intent. And what a corrupt intent actually entails is going to be largely up to the view of the jurors who are going to deliberate in the case. But I think they're going to make the claim that what Judge Dugan was attempting to do was to really ascertain what the ICE agents were going to do. What was their plan for making this arrest? And did they have the approval of the chief judge to be inside the courthouse? Had there been some agreement about that? What exactly was the process that was going to unfold that day just outside of her courtroom? And she made claim that she was also concerned about public safety. And so I think there's going to be a real push to say her intent was not corrupt. It was actually the opposite of corrupt. It was one where she was interested in maintaining the decorum and orderliness of the courthouse. And then again, I think they're going to target this idea that she actively concealed someone. The person was in a public courtroom. In her courtroom, they used the side door to exit back into a public hallway. And so I think they're going to challenge the notion that Judge Dugan both had a corrupt intent and that she actively concealed someone from federal law enforcement.
John, do you think we'll hear from Dugan?
It's always a little dicey to make that guess. But if I was going to make a guess here, I would say yes. I would say that most juries, despite the fact they're instructed to not hold it against the defendant if they don't testify, most jurors appreciate hearing from the defendant. And this is a case where, again, I think Judge Dugan has plenty of an explanation to give to the jurors about why she may have been doing what she did on that day. And that's such a critical part of the case. I would expect she would probably take the stand in her own defense.
Jacob, on a larger level here, how does this case affect immigrants?
So there's a number of responses to that. I think the first thing, regardless of the outcome here, is what we've been seeing with the increased immigration enforcement under this administration has been that we're seeing immigration enforcement enter to a much larger degree into more and more areas of public life. So that can be immigration agents coming to courthouses, but also to schools, hospitals, places of worship, places where ICE agents had typically not conducted enforcement in the past. And so I think regardless of the outcome in this case, we're seeing that these federal immigration priorities are taking precedent over some important public policy concerns about making sure that people can come to these types of places, particularly to attend their court hearings if they have to appear in court in a place like here in Milwaukee County. And so we're seeing people being afraid, right, to come to court out of fear of ICE enforcement. And I think the choice to prosecute Judge Dugan in this case, I think we can see this as part of the Trump administration's broader strategy of trying to, through various techniques, put pressure on state and local officials to cooperate with the administration's agenda of mass deportations. On the one hand, you've seen a significant amount of money under the reconciliation bill from this past summer going to state and local jurisdictions that decided to actively to cooperate with the federal government in its immigration enforcement. But now, on the other hand, you see that if for state and local officials that are at least perceived as not cooperating with that enforcement agenda, you know, the possible consequences might include prosecution and conviction of individual officials like we're seeing in this case.
Yeah, you know, John, Attorney General Pam Bondi had said earlier this year that the case shows there are consequences for judges who don't, you know, who interfere with immigration policies. Do you anticipate this case could have a chilling effect on the judicial system?
Well, I do think that's why the case, at least in part, was brought, that this is meant to have a chilling effect. Generally speaking, immigration enforcement is solely the prerogative of the federal government. State courts, state law enforcement agencies are under no obligation to participate in immigration enforcement. But I think the message here is clear that any attempt to interfere, obstruct, or dissuade the enforcement of immigration laws in courthouses, in any public space, is going to be met with stiff resistance from the federal government, and they will use all the tools at their disposal to discourage any type of interference, or in this case, even questioning of ICE agents when they're trying to conduct immigration enforcement.
Well, John and Jacob, thank you both so much for your analysis. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy to do it.
Jacob Hamburger there, an assistant law professor at Marquette University's Law School. And John Gross is the director of the Public Defender Project at UW-Madison's Law School and a clinical associate professor. We've been talking about the federal trial of Milwaukee Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan, charged with concealing an immigrant back in April. Her trial gets underway today.
Coming up, how do businesses comply with new and ever-changing tariff policies? A U.S. customs broker in Wisconsin talks about the new compliance issues that are causing bottlenecks.
For importers, they have their brokers taking longer to get things done. Auditing those transactions to even know, like, hey, did I pay the right duty, is very difficult.
Navigating tariffs, that's next on WPR News.
Since the Trump administration ramped up global tariffs, one of the pain points is turning out to be the administrative costs associated with complying with the rules.
It's kind of like detective work. Compliance might involve tracing the origin of small parts and materials that make up an item. Let's say my business imports window frames. Those frames have some aluminum and vinyl in them, also some insulation. The documentation on the amount of aluminum and tracing where it came from would be part of my compliance work.
Shannon Bryant is president of Trade IQ. That's a Wisconsin firm assisting small and mid-sized businesses trying to adhere to new trade rules. Shannon, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with some basics here. What does it mean to have rules and regulations related to tariffs, and how have the complexity of those rules changed under this Trump administration?
Well, before I answer that, I'd like to set a little bit of a framework for a mental model for people. So just like when you file your income taxes every year, you file a 1040 form on your income taxes. The same thing happens when you import goods into a country, into any country. It's effectively a tax declaration. So taxes were just assessed, or the duty rate was assessed on the commodity. So every commodity that comes into the country is identified through a harmonized tariff code, and that code would determine the rate. So a pencil would have the same duty rate from Mexico, from the EU, from somewhere in Africa, didn't matter. In coming into the United States, it always had the same rate. In our current environment, that is very different now. And the reason for that is that all of these new tariffs that have been implemented in 2025 are provisional tariffs. so each one is identified by a different provisional code. So the way to think about that is, before, if I was importing a shipment of pencils, I would have one commodity code and one value and one origin for that shipment. Now, any one shipment might have as many as 5, actually up to 32 different provisional codes. Mm-hmm. So every broker in the United States' workload, their data entry for when they're keying those tax declarations, went up by a factor of 5x. They didn't have that many more people, yeah. Right? It's not like they had a bunch of additional resources they weren't already using. So that's really constrained the entire workforce for customs brokerage. In the United States, you have to be a licensed U.S. customs broker. So there is a limited number of us who actually are legally allowed to do this. So it really does create a bottleneck. Add to that that all of that complexity lends itself to error, right? And so for importers, they have their brokers taking longer to get things done, auditing those transactions to even know, like, hey, did I pay the right duty?
Yeah.
Is very difficult. And then if you want to go back and fix it, good luck.
That has also some ripple effects as well. And I'm wondering, you know, will we see audits by the government in 2026 more as these new rules start to really get, you know, take effect?
So we actually already have seen U.S. Customs and Border Protection. We already have seen them start to issue what they call a CF-29. So that's request for information. CF-28s and CF-29s are specific customs forms where they say, hey, prove to me this is correct. One of the things that we're seeing, Section 232 for the steel aluminum tariffs, for example, is that importers were allowed to only pay the 50% tariff that applies on just the steel or aluminum value. But then, okay, so what is the steel or aluminum value? It was incredibly ambiguous. And I myself talked to 3 different customs officers. I got 3 different answers. So it was very much subject to interpretation, and different importers took a different interpretation, rightly or wrongly, due to a lack of guidance, right?
Yeah.
Now, when we're seeing those CF-29s and we see exactly what customs is asking for, and then some recent guidance put out by the base metal C is very different than what the importers were interpreting, right? So that's one risk area that definitely a lot of importers, not through anything nefarious, right, are going to end up with significant risk exposure for that reason.
Just because they interpreted something one way and customs is interpreting something another way. What I want to find out from you, you've mentioned steel and aluminum here a couple times. You know, more than a quarter of Wisconsin's manufacturing base is heavily dependent on metals, on steel and aluminum. You know, do you see more complicated compliance issues when products contain metals?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One thing that's actually kind of interesting about that, and I'll use a product I'm kind of familiar with as an example. So motorcycle parts are subject to Section 232 steel, but not Section 232 aluminum. So if you bring in some motorcycle forks, for example, they're going to flag for Section 232 steel. But what if your forks are aluminum? You still have the extra work and extra administrative burden, those extra provisional codes, to say, no, this is exempt because it doesn't contain steel. So you still have to do that extra work.
That burden of proof.
Right. So even if your stuff isn't really contain what they're looking for. The other component to that that is particularly burdensome and importers are having a really tough time with is the additional reporting requirements for the country of melt and pour for steel or the country of smelt and cast for aluminum. That's not a normal thing that anyone would have ever gotten before. So this is like a whole new body of work for any kind of decent-sized company. This is a full-time job. By itself, right? Because you have to go to every different supplier and get what is a mill test certificate to determine it for steel and a certificate of analysis to confirm the melt country for aluminum. So you have to go to your suppliers. Now, what if you have, let's use my motorcycle forks example again, what if you have several different suppliers with components on there, and now you have to declare that for each one. So if you have, if your $100 set of forks, and it is steel, you, and you have $50 of steel from China and $25 from Europe, and now you're just adding more lines to be able to declare that. And the final part about that that's really, really challenging is there is no de minimis value. So
these are for goods $800 or less, or the, that rule?
De minimis is actually used, the terminology is used a couple different ways.
Okay.
It means like a negligible value.
Okay.
There is no negligible value that you can discount it. So if your item has like no steel except for the screws, you still have to report the value of the screws and the country of melt and pour. I can tell you, like, your hardware supplier, that you typically are buying that from a distributor, not the actual manufacturer, and they have no idea. So you can't get this information even if you wanted to, and if you say unknown other, you pay 200% Russia rate on it.
What is Russia rate?
The Russia has a special rate. So if it's steel coming from Russia, it's 200% instead of the 50%.
Why is that?
Because we're angry at Russia, I guess.
The White House is arguing that tariffs will help to bring back manufacturing to U.S. soil. Do you think that will happen? Do you see that argument?
I'll be honest, amongst the folks that I've talked to, it's done exactly the opposite. I've seen one client that is closing shop in the United States and moving their business to Europe. I've seen several have to do reorgs or layoffs. Almost everyone that I've worked with has said they've seen some demand softening due to price increases that they've had to push through to their clients, and they're starting to feel that pain. So in the short term, I don't see how that's possible.
But what if you are a U.S. company making a U.S. widget with all U.S. materials? Could the tariffs be beneficial?
There's always some winners, right? Mm. So, yes, I suppose that that is potentially true. One thing that I'd probably caveat that, though, is even if someone says, I buy all U.S. origin materials, great. So your supplier is making that thing with all U.S. origin materials. That is a very unique set of circumstances, and I would think it's a very narrow set of industries where that would be true. Like, for example, in the United States, paper. We make all of our own paper here. All of our capital equipment for paper products uses virgin materials. This is predominantly U.S. You don't have a whole lot of foreign competition for paper products. But even paper companies where it's, yeah, it's U.S. paper, but caustic and other materials that go into that chemical process.
Yeah, the chemical processes.
They're imported. So, so it would be very, very unusual that you don't have any foreign trace elements in even a very U.S. good.
One more thing here. Tariff amounts have changed over time after negotiations with countries. You know, goods imported from China have experienced some of the most dramatic swings. How do tariff rate fluctuations affect importers? Could they potentially even get some money back if tariffs go up and down the rate?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So some of Japan is a great example where they retroactively reduced the reciprocal country rate for Japan and backdated it to August 1st. So, yes, you could file post-summary corrections on those and you could get a refund on that. That's not free to do because your broker's not doing free work. It has to be filed with customs. So there's a cost to go get.
Yeah.
So there are some opportunities for that. And again, adding to the broker burden, right, we have an unprecedented number of corrections getting pushed through. And there's a lot of importers that their broker won't do it.
Mm.
They just don't have the resource capacity or they, you know, they try to find somebody else. So they kind of get stuck with it, even though they are eligible, but they can't find anybody to file it.
Shannon, thank you so much for explaining this. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Shannon Bryant, president of Trade IQ. It's a Wisconsin firm that helps companies comply with trade rules. We've been talking about how small businesses are navigating tariff compliance issues.
Coming up, memory choirs in northern Wisconsin are a creative outlet for people living with dementia and Parkinson's disease.
It's really helped to strengthen their voice, as well as make social connections and find community.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Research shows that singing has a positive effect on our health and mental well-being.
And singing together in a group can boost social connections, even help with memory.
That's where memory choirs come in. They're singing groups meant to help seniors coping with memory loss from dementia or Alzheimer's disease. These choirs help them reclaim their voices and find community through song.
Vince Schurin is a performing and teaching musician based in Saxon in northern Wisconsin. He offers musical services through his project Spoons for the People and leads two community choirs in the area, Melody Lane, a memory choir, and Parkinsong for people with Parkinson's disease. Vince, welcome to the show.
Of course. Yeah, happy to be here.
Well, for people who aren't familiar, what is a memory choir?
Yeah, so a memory choir is basically a community choir that is open to anyone. And the only difference really is that there are certain things that we take into consideration to make sure that participation in the choir is inclusive and accessible for people with memory loss or other cognitive issues.
When people with that kind of memory loss are participating in this case, Melody Lane, what kind of response do you see from them? What do you see maybe change on their faces as they start to get into the singing?
What I hear from choir members and care partners is often that singers with memory loss really light up and they engage with their environment more than they normally do. When we sing songs, especially that they're familiar with, that they remember, they sing along and they have big smiles on their faces. One of our recent concert attendees said that it was so great to see all of the singers' faces light up while they were singing, and especially those with memory loss.
Well, let's give a little listen to the Melody Lane singers. Here's a theme song I understand you wrote for them. That's the Melody Lane singers. Vince, tell us a little bit about how it came together and how the first season went as you were teaching and working with the Melody Lane singers.
Yeah, how it came about was there's a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis called the Giving Voice Initiative, and they are doing this rural initiatives program to try to help a handful of new choirs get started, new memory choirs get started. And so they reached out to me and asked if I would want to start one in Ashland. And I said yes. So they helped by providing grant funding. They also provided a lot of logistical support, advice, some templates and materials that we might use, and were just very supportive and mentored us in getting the choir started here.
Now you're working with Melody Lane. You have another project. You're the director for Parkinsong. Tell us a little bit about the story behind Parkinsong.
Yeah, the Parkinsong Choir, it was going for about 8 years or so, but had a break during COVID, as many choirs and other organizations did. So then they didn't meet up for a handful of years, and then they asked me if I would want to help kind of revive the choir, get it going again. And I said yes. So now I'm currently in my third year of directing the Parkinsong Choir, and it is just an incredible group of people. We sing in four-part harmony, and it is facilitated and operated by the Bay Area Parkinson's Support Group.
What are some of the challenges for people with Parkinson's when they want to get together and sing with others?
I think some of the challenges might include, maybe not having the strongest voice when they first start out. And so they might be a little bit nervous to join a choir because they feel like they won't be welcome. And luckily, some of our singers in the Parkinson choir who have Parkinson's disease have reported that since singing regularly with a choir, it's really helped to strengthen their voice, as well as make social connections and find community and other great things like that.
Part of the social connection here, and this is something you mentioned on the websites for the groups, is there's an intergenerational element to it, where you have people of different ages and backgrounds getting together. Why is that important?
It's important because it is one of the superpowers of music. It is. There are a lot of different activities or groups or organizations that can be intergenerational, and that's all wonderful. I think some of them, there are certain barriers for intergenerational participation. Some of them it's easier, some of them it's harder. With choral singing, it's super easy. Everybody can sing together and work on their voices blending together, work on unifying, work on creating something together. And it's just a great activity that is accessible for everybody, for people who are young, who are old, who have Parkinson's, who have memory loss, who just want to be more involved in the community and reap the benefits that group singing has to offer. You know, it's such a great medicine for people to come together and sing together.
We're talking to Vince Schurin, a performing and teaching musician in northern Wisconsin. He leads several community choirs, including the ones we're talking about, Parkinson and Melody Lane. Vince, with these projects, and you also have a project called Spoons for the People, there's a mission here that I really love, the idea that, hey, whoever you are, however skilled you might be or not be, you can find joy in creating music. Why is this such an important thing for you to help bring to the world as a musician?
Yeah, that's something that I feel particularly passionate about. I think it is important because of where we are right now as a society. There is, just working as a voice teacher, as a choir director, we have so much vocal trauma as people. I hear it all the time from people who heard from somebody when they were a kid that they couldn't sing, or they should just lip sync in the choir, or they can't sing. And then they take that with them. People take that with them for the rest of their lives and think, oh, this is something that only famous people who are talented at singing should do. This isn't something that I should do. And that's just not true. It's a medicine. It's a community building tool that is our right as humans, that anybody can access and should be able to access without that vocal shame. So I do try to encourage people and remind them of that in choirs and in voice lessons.
Looking at the song selection, especially from Melody Lane singers, you often focus on things from generations ago, Cat Stevens, Paul Simon, some of their earlier songs. And I understand sometimes with a memory loss, those lyrics that we encountered maybe when we were in our teens or 20s, those can come back. Talk about the strategy for choosing those songs that that might find themselves coming back for people with memory loss.
Yeah, there is a lot of science out there about how music relates with language, right? That's why kids are singing all the time. They often make up songs. There is a rhythm to speaking. When I speak like this, it is quasi-rhythmic. So there are all these interesting connections between music and language. And I think that when people hear a song that they recognize, that they've heard since they were younger, it really wakes up their memory in ways that other things might not be able to access.
Can you leave us with some encouragement to people listening to check out a choir, whether it's a memory choir that fits their needs or Parkinson if they're in your neck of the woods or anywhere for any reason? Encourage people to get together and sing with other humans.
Absolutely. I really encourage everybody to pursue singing, to try out singing. Whether you do it at home by yourself, whether you do it in the car, as many people do, or in the shower. And then if you do find that you enjoy that, then it may take a little bit of time, a little bit of research, maybe a little bit of driving if you live in a rural area. But yes, I encourage you to research what options are available for community choirs. Find one that you think might be a good fit for you, and then just give it a try. See what happens.
Vince, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Vince Schurin, singer and music educator based in Iron County. He's been telling us about Parkin's Song and Melody Lane, two memory choirs he directs in northern Wisconsin. We're going out on What a Wonderful World, performed by Parkin's Song Choir from Washburn.